praise team, praise band, all our tech crew, folks making that possible. I got several emails this week from folks who were not in this room last Sunday, but who were watching online, some who were at work and said, I caught it later, and just talked so much about how much it means to them. That's not possible without the men and women of all ages who take part in our tech crew. So thank all you folks for what you do week by week. And when somebody like Kath and her husband Doug, who are both anchors in that ministry, are out because of a COVID experience that they're wrestling with a little bit, they're doing fine, but they could not be here, we feel that. So volunteers, new people, opportunities for you to step up, take a turn in the rotation, we welcome that. Okay, so today we are returning to our series study on Wordle, which I've been tickled. My wife has gotten into it now, so every now and then she'll come along and say, I'm working on this one. I don't know if it's cheating or not. Sometimes we put our brains together for a minute, see what we can do. The importance of words simply cannot be overstated, right? And we've said there are key biblical words that we recognize. If you want to have a fully developed sense of what it means to be a faithful follower of Jesus, if you want to understand what it means to walk in His ways, to enjoy His gifts, to celebrate His goodness, there are some words that you need to grasp better, that we all need to talk about together, be reminded of some things. And so the first week we looked at the word happy, and we talked about what does it really mean to know the joy of the Lord, to be happy, as He says, to experience the blessed life. And we gave that a good focus. We celebrated and enjoyed it, only to come back the second week when our word was very different, the word death. And when we planned the series, that was the week for that word. We had planned on Memorial Day to have a very happy sermon about death, to talk about legacy and what we all leave behind, and what a difference you've made and what a difference you can make. And instead, it was a very tumultuous week, as we all know. Peter mentioned in his introduction earlier about the loss of the kids in Uvalde, and of course, that's not the only incident. We talked about, once again, how important it is as the community of faith to be able to share responses of support, to walk through grief together, to find comfort together, to reemphasize how dependent we are on God for strength, and how important the beloved community of God's people is as we participate in it. And now today we're going to move into another Wordle, and I just have to say up front, I'm very indebted to the writing of a fellow by the name of Aaron Damiani for some insights. But before I start into the new word, I want to go back to last week's word one more time, the word death. I often tell you folks that when we preach a message, the weeks leading up to it and the weeks after it are difficult weeks oftentimes for pastors, because for God to bring us to a place where we're ready to talk about it with you is a lot of preparation and study, and God is working on us. But oftentimes, like can happen with teachers of any subject, we're teaching it, you know, as we're absorbing it and passing it along, and then we're still dealing with it afterwards. There's kind of an echoing effect. Some of you last week wanted to debrief the sermon after I got through, and I just said, thank you, I need some time, I need some space. That sermon was written in a short amount of time following the events of Uvalde, and so it just made it a difficult time. And sure enough, death was not ready to be done when we walked away last Sunday. Now, we all know, we knew that people would be dying in the days after, but for me, I lost a dear friend, and for this church, we lost a dear friend. One of our beloved members who passed away this week, her memorial service will be next Saturday at 1 p.m., and I hope as many of you as will want to join us will do so. I'm speaking of Marie Satterwhite. Now, some of you did not know Marie very well. Let's just put it this way. She was 98 years old, and she spent 71 years as a member of this church and its roots, right? She was an amazing person. Got several pictures from her life that are going to show up behind me while I'm talking for just a minute. She was the last remaining charter member which means she was there at the beginning, of either of our founding congregations. She joined First Baptist Church of Wheaton in 1951. I was born in 1959. People think it's remarkable that I've been a pastor of the same congregation for 31 years. How about somebody who's been a member for 71 years? Absolutely mind-boggling. She lived, their house was about 3 miles up Georgia Avenue from the church in Wheaton in those days, one of our founding congregations. She brought her family in the 50s. These are her two precious daughters. One of them is still with us, and she'll be here hosting the event, of course, next Saturday. That's Carol. But the other two children preceded Marie in death. And so she lived through a lot. She experienced so much. She taught Sunday school to children for 40 years. 40. An entire generation of children. And then she retired to become a member of the senior adult ladies Sunday school class, where she was a member for another 31 years. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to think about that kind of commitment. And oh, by the way, when I met Marie in the early 90s, it was a few years later that I asked her to be the church clerk. And she served as the church clerk for 25 years, and that was in the days when you had to send little letters to every church when somebody joined. It wasn't computer, it wasn't an email, it wasn't 5 seconds and done. There was a very strict procedure for how you process them in, how you process them out, the letters of appreciation that you would send out. She would produce the baptismal certificates. She recorded all the new members. We have lists in her handwriting that go back decades. Absolutely amazing service that she rendered to the church. And she volunteered on top of all that, as she had served as a professional secretary in her work life, in addition to raising three children. And so when she retired, she volunteered one day a week in the church office to be the secretary to the secretary, and do whatever needed to be done. Bulk mailing, taking the flowers that were here on Sunday and dividing them up into smaller arrangements, and then delivering them to the sick and the shut-in. And I mean, just an amazing person. And I will just say this, absolutely invaluable, that type of volunteer service. Unerringly accurate in the service that she offered to the church and to God. And most importantly, unfailingly cheerful. I never knew Marie, in all the years I knew her, and I knew her 31 years, to not be a cheerful person. When we formed Pathways with a merger, and that, of course, meant saying goodbye, in a sense, to what we all had been in our various congregations, there was no one who had invested more in First Baptist Wheaton and in Streams of Hope, and she was so excited to form Pathways. She got to be a charter member of three congregations without ever changing churches. I mean, that's what she was able to do as she progressed through church life over 71 years. She was so excited about the future of Pathways. And I will tell you this, she was one of those people that kind of became a tradition in the church in those days. Those of us who were in our 30s and 40s would walk around and we would say stuff like this. We'd say, I want to be like Marie Satterwhite when I grow up. Because we realized that at 40, we still had a lot of growing to do. And that ending the race well, like she was doing, was absolutely our goal. Now, I have to tell one more story about her. And I'm wearing my hat in her honor. This is my hat. I know you can't read it. It says, Icy Strait Point. It's an island up in Alaska. And our family went on an Alaska trip in about 2010 or so. And in Alaska, on this island, it's a volcanic island, very steep, not a lot of island to it. They set up a zip line from the top of the highest point in the mountain down to the beach, as far as they could stretch it, a mile and a quarter. You hit 65 miles an hour in a chair as you come down a zip line. It's a mile and a quarter long, 65 miles an hour. We came back. I showed the video on the screen as a storytelling thing for the church family about stepping out in faith or something. I'm sure it was very clever at the time. Marie saw that. She came up to me and she said, I want to do that. And I'm thinking, you're 85 years old. You're not going to do. 3 years later, at age 88, that's her coming down that same zip line. And when she got back, and we watched the video again, talked about it, she said, I want to go. If you're up for it, I'd like to go back and do it again. We never had the opportunity, but God bless him. Pastor Larry, right? I think it was for her 90th birthday, gave her, you know, they have these in Maryland too. They're not the world's longest. They don't go 65 miles an hour. But at age 90, Marie climbed up the trees to the platform to get to the level, goes across holding the rope to get to the launch platform, and she did it. Her 65-year-old daughter refused to do it. But at age 90, Marie did it. A woman of great courage, of great faith, unfailing love. I just had to give her a shout out. And she's really an example of our Wordle for today. So let's talk about that. I think about today's word, it's a word that reminds me of what it means to be in a genuine Christian family, to live authentically as a Christian community. They are the people who are the saints of God on this earth. They are loving, kind, gracious people, flawed though we all are. There is no perfect church. We tell people all the time, if you came here looking for the perfect church and you're about to join here, please don't, because we will fail next week or we'll fail this afternoon. We are an imperfect people in an imperfect church who love a perfect God and are doing our best to follow after him. So as I think about what it means to be a part of God's people, as I reflected a few weeks ago on 31 years as pastor, I spent time thinking about how blessed it is, the privilege of being allowed to share deeply, not just on the periphery, but deeply in people's lives through their weddings, the births of their children, and baptisms and anniversaries last week. What a wonderful time celebrating 60 years with the Teagues at their 60th wedding anniversary. And yes, even funerals, when you can celebrate them the way we're going to celebrate Marie's life this coming Saturday. See, family life like that together means you have the risk of pain because you have to be vulnerable. People know you well and you are exposed, but it also means we have a greater opportunity to receive love and to be so blessed on a journey. So the secret to long marriages, long church memberships, long relationships, long friendships, and long pastorates is simply this. It's the word grace. It's the word grace. Now, here's what you need to know, that for every group of people, every community of folks like us, you need to be aware that at some point in the journey, actually probably multiple points in the journey, that's been my experience, there is a fork in the road that you will come to. And you will have to be making a decision that affects you, may affect me, it may affect all of us. You may not have really faced this fork yet. I would celebrate that if that's true for you. But I would say in my experience of 31 years, it comes to everyone eventually. It's not the doomsday fork. I'm not talking about coming to face death. I'm talking about the difficulty of relationships. When one day, the person you love, the person you trust, that friend that's had your back for I don't know how many years, they're going to drop the ball. Or you are. And somebody's going to get hurt, and there's going to be a wound, and there's a fork in the road that you come to when you are hurt by one another. The people that you've been making friends with, and you've been enjoying, and you've been hanging out with, and maybe you've even kind of looked up to them, and they're on a little bit of a pedestal in your friendship, and they get knocked down because something happens where they criticize you. Or they annoy the heck out of you with something they do. Or they frustrate you. Or maybe they exclude you from something, either accidentally or maybe you feel like it's on purpose. And when we find ourselves on the receiving end of that, when we find ourselves annoyed or exasperated or frustrated, then we find ourselves standing at a fork in the road. We have to make a decision about which direction we're going to go. And unfortunately, and I use that word with great sincerity, with no small sense of human tragedy, is that the default path that most people take at that fork when relationships turn a little bit sour, when there's a little bit of frustration, when there's a hurt, it's the path that I would refer to today as disposable grace and disposable relationships. There was a popular movie a few years ago, and its character, one of the characters, made a little speech that kind of fits this. He was a businessman who traveled a fair bit. Here's what he said. He said, "Everywhere I travel, it's a tiny life." Think about that for me. He said, "The single serving sugar, single serving cream, single pad of butter, a shampoo conditioner combo in a tiny bottle, a sample of packaged mouthwash, tiny little bars of soap." And then he closed it with saying, "The people I meet on each flight I take are like single serving friendships." Now, the script writer, the narrator of that movie, was not just describing the fact that we all meet people in life, some for longer periods and some for shorter. We do have a category of friends that we call acquaintances. Certainly, that's not what he's really lamenting, because that's actually a normal part. It's a progression of relationships, of course. But what he's lamenting with this talk of single-serving friends is that this businessman had realized, the scriptwriter had probably realized in his or her own life, that many relationships, that many of the people that had come through their life had become, in essence, disposable. And it left him with a profound sense of loneliness, emptiness, disconnectedness. And when we choose to go down the path of disposable grace, disposable relationships, see, we go down there, we have the right to just all of a sudden, boom, in, be done with people. We dispose them as soon as they become inconvenient, as soon as they become an annoyance, as soon as they've been any kind of a source of pain. Another way to look at it is to say, as soon as they become costly. So maybe when there's pain, when there's neglect, when there's criticism, when we've been dismissed, when we feel like we've been wounded, we just dispose of that relationship. We leave them behind. That is the path, too often the default path at the fork in the road, that we call disposable grace and disposable relationships. Now, I do want to give a caveat there, because this needs to be said in our world today. Sometimes we have to lose a relationship because we're in a relationship that is unhealthy, where you're being harmed. I don't want there to be any mistake that we're going to judge somebody for saying, "I had to get out of there." No. As a matter of fact, if you're feeling that way, call on us now. Let us know how we can help you, how we can counsel you, how we can support you and love you in the difficulty you're facing. It's true that sometimes there's a relationship and we need to disengage from it. And I would just want to recommend those of you who are maybe wrestling with this, or you've got a friend who's got a struggle with it, there's a book called Necessary Transitions by Henry Cloud. He's a very well-known, trustworthy Christian counselor. Necessary Transitions. I'm not here to encourage people to throw relationships overboard, to throw your children out, to get a divorce, to break up. That's not the point of it. There is a fact, though, in life that we need to be able to grow and understand what's going on in our life and stay healthy in our move. And Cloud uses the illustration. He said, there's a reason that most of us don't marry our prom date. Now, I think I'm going to have to go here to the Bushmans and say, if you went to prom, right, and you went together. I know that some people actually managed to pull that off. But Cloud says, you know, for most of us, there's a reason We're at an age, we're at a point in a relationship that's going to change. We realize this is not our permanent setup for us. He said, there's a reason most of us don't take one job and stay at it our whole life. And I would just add in, I may have 31 years here, but it was not my first job. So I felt safe making that comment today. There's a reason most of us don't just stay in the first place we ever got hired. That there are necessary transitions in life, and you have to move beyond, listen to me, especially previous preferences. We get locked into those sometimes, and we think that those are laws because we like things a certain way. And we get mad at people who don't fit into that, and it's just a preference. And sometimes we talk about needing to adjust ourselves and compromise. Well, compromise is a dirty word. No, it's a necessary transition if you're going to be in relationship with other human beings. Just make sure it's a healthy, necessary transition. All that's normal, healthy, I affirm that very, very much. I think the real danger is that too many people, including many Christians who are supposed to live together in authentic community, and we lean into the bad temptation of running away at the first hint of pain and trouble. Well, I don't know if that's for me anymore. And it comes out a lot of ways. If we're not getting the recognition we think we deserve, or there's even a whiff of criticism of something I'm doing, then we just say, heck with that, I'm out of there. And we disengage and we run away because it's our choice, it's our right. We have this freedom to do that. And I was thinking about that, and I thought, do we really have that freedom? So bluntly like that. Because treating other people like they're disposable in a community shared life, did you know that's really a fairly recent development, right? I mean, if you've read books from generations ago, and you understand people who lived in a community, and there was the grumpy neighbor, well, you know, there were only 15 people in that community. Nobody was getting up and going anywhere. They owned a farm. They weren't going to move because they couldn't get along with you. You had to learn to get along with your neighbors. Now, I understand people across history have always been able to choose their friends. I get that. But this idea that we can just get away from anybody who disagrees with us, pick and move to another state because it's blue or it's red or it's purple, or I just want to find people who think, or I'm going to pick up from this church and go to that church because everybody there thinks like I do. Oh, yeah, open your mind and you'll discover that that's not the case, right? I can testify. I grew up in a small town. There was one elementary school. There were 30 kids, pretty much, 25 to 30, in each grade. My brother went to that school for 7 years. He was with the same 25 kids for 7 years in elementary school. We moved to another town. My dad got a different job. Guess how many junior highs there were? One. And so I went to junior high. And when I graduated from there, guess I went to the one high school. And there were people in my grade and in my class, and you all know these experiences, right? That you would not have as your best friend, you wouldn't necessarily like to hang out with them, but maybe because your name begins with the same letter, you're sitting next to them every day for an hour or 2 hours, or depending on the, it's just how it is. This idea that I pick up and go where I want with who I want is a relatively modern development. So we have gotten used to kind of in modern life, we keep our finger near the eject button. And sometimes it's to eject ourselves, and sometimes it's to eject the other person. We want them out. We want them gone. And that's this disposable type of grace and disposable type of relationships. And here's the problem. When we do that, when we treat people like that, when we get rid of relationships right as they get difficult, we are often ending a relationship just before it becomes fruitful, just before it bears fruit. We disengage before the journey with them is complete. I give it the illustration of a fruit tree, and those who've got the app open, you're seeing the comparison there. See, you take a fruit tree, and those of you who farm some, you know this. You plant a fruit tree, you water it, you fertilize it, you spray it, you protect it from insects, you protect it from deer or whatever else might be harmful to it. All that stuff, you do that for years, before most fruit trees bear fruit. Anybody here like apples? 2 to 5 years. Apricots? 2 to 5 years. Banana plants? 2 to 3 years. So I guess if you're hungry, you plant those, but you got to live in the right climate. Sweet cherries. We were having sweet cherries yesterday at our house. I loved this. I had done my sermon preparation. I buy them for my daughter who really loves cherries. I said, "You enjoying that?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Guess how long it takes a cherry tree to bear fruit?" 4 to 7 years before sweet cherry trees bear fruit. Olives, 2 to 3 years. You can have them. I don't eat those. Peaches, 4 to 6 years. Pears, 4 to 6 years. It takes time. Now, folks, you're getting the point here, aren't you? In the relationships of our lives, there's variation. Some friends bear fruit in your life in the first months. Some take years, and some really surprise you years later, especially in church life. I have found this to be true. There were relationships where they were more engaged in other things, other staff people, their own lives, and only later did I get to know them really well myself. And you see this richness that comes out of their lives. So churches are a case in point that right about the time some of our relationships are becoming fruitful in this environment that's centered around Jesus, something goes wrong and we are tempted to uproot our tree and take our tree with us and go somewhere else because we are dissatisfied about something. Somebody said something. I've had a hurt. I've had a pain. And we need to be very careful about treating people and our families and our church families like they are disposable. If you think you can go somewhere where you're never hurt and never challenged, you are dreaming. So we are all in a place that we need to acknowledge reality and say, what is what God is doing, and how's that involved in here? And so instead of taking the path of disposable grace and missing out, some of you know that, you know, my son gave us some challenges. I didn't plan on saying this. Son gave us some challenges as he got into college. As the Bible says, all we like sheep have gone astray, and he decided to give that a whirl for a while, you know. And there was a period there of several years where we were not on the same page. We loved each other, but we were not all on the same page. Managed to get him to finish 2 years of school with a lot of struggle and fight and conniving and everything else, and then he moved off to make his own life. He called back about a year ago, said, "Hey, Mom, Dad, I want to go back to college and finish my degree." And so, you know, we talked about that. He's been in that process. Talked to him this week. He said, oh, by the way, you know, we're finishing the conversation. Been talking a half an hour. He's, "Oh, by the way, I got straight A's." You know, now, you may think being that proud of an almost 30-year-old getting straight, but for me, to know the journey he's been through and to see the fruit, and many of you, right, all you parents, and almost every parent knows this, and for you young parents, we love you, and we hope everything goes peaches and cream for you, but parents that are in the room, yeah, not so much. I mean, we also, yeah, there's sweetness that comes, and there are going to be days where you have to say, "I got to hang on and know it's years before some of this will bear fruit." This is the message of the Bible, and so what I want to say to you is that there is an alternative to disposable grace and disposable relationships, and it's what Damiani, I love this word, this is what Damiani calls sturdy grace. Or I prefer the biblical word. It took sturdy to get my attention to it. The Bible uses the word enduring. This is what it's about, enduring grace. Not momentary, not disposable, but enduring grace. And that's what Jesus laid out for us in John 13. And if you have your Bible, you can open it to it, because I'm not going to read the passage today. It's a very long passage. It's the story of Jesus washing the disciples' feet shortly before the crucifixion. So you can turn there and be looking at it. I encourage you to do so. But it's a story, I think, of enduring grace. And by the way, this idea that God's love and God's grace endures for us, it also comes from 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7, right? You remember that verse? Love bears all things, hopes all things, believes all things, endures all things. I like to say the fact that God's grace endures all things is more than a wedding slogan. It's about life in the community of faith. That's what God's love, God's grace is all about. So the grace that we have to offer one another in our own strength, let's be honest, if it's just up to you and me, the best we can hope for sometimes is just being polite. Sometimes it takes all we can do to suck it up in our own energy and say, I'm going to be polite to that person, but things are hard right now. They've not been smooth between us. And it's kind of almost a self-interested or self-serving grace. But here's the thing. If we can lean into God's grace, which is durable, it's stronger. As a matter of fact, it's stronger than death. It's stronger than criticism. It's stronger than failure. It's stronger than preferences. God's grace is like a fruit tree that survives winter, that survives pruning, that survives injury, and it just keeps pushing. Matter of fact, the pruning makes it stronger. The survival that it fights for from seasons of difficulty makes it a stronger tree. And in the end, what comes out is rich, abiding fruit. So God's grace, understand how it works. It can take the cuts that we have suffered and turn them into compassion for others because we realize how painful being cut can be. That's God's grace, God's enduring grace. God's grace can take failure and bear the fruit of forgiveness. God's grace can take treason and betrayal and bear the fruit of tenderness. He brings great fruit from relational failure. So when we walk in the path of enduring grace, which is ours through the death and resurrection of Jesus, that's how God, His grace begins to bear fruit in us. And so kind of turning your mind to this passage in John 13, just pieces of it for a moment. This is the passage where He washes the disciples' feet. In verse 1, it says of chapter 13 that He loved His disciples to the end. In some translation, it says to the full, or to the fullness of God's grace, that He had a rich and abiding and enduring sense of love for them. Not single serving, friends. He loved His disciples to the end. So Jesus didn't run out when things got messy. You may remember that throughout the course of Jesus' life, people came and people went. Disciples stepped up and disciples failed like crazy. There were people who were willing to follow Him for a little bit, but then they left. He had this sense of grace and peace and confidence that the Father would work through all those relationships. He didn't beat people up about it. He didn't cast people out. He loved. And so when we get to this chapter in 13, John 13, and He calls His disciples who've gotten all this love from Him. And remember, the Bible says He knew all along that one would betray Him. Interesting. So he knows that this is going on in their lives. He referenced it in verse 21. He knew that one of them would betray Him. He had referenced it at other times as well. But He didn't run away from the disciples and say, you know what, if one of them's going to betray me, if I run away from all of them, nobody's left to betray me. He hung with them. He kept showing love. He kept showing grace. And even when He knew that it was Judas, He stayed engaged with Judas and use this opportunity to show him great love. So remember what's going on. They're in the upper room, right? They're having the Lord's Supper, what we're going to share right here together in just a moment. All that's going on. Verse 2 says that during the supper, the devil had already put it in Judas's heart to betray Jesus. And Jesus knew that, but He also knew that His life was in the hands of the Father. He'd already prayed, you know. He knew Not my will, but thine be done, right? That this is where he's committed to going. He's going to focus on what the Father says. So he's there. Imagine this with me, please. I know you've heard the story a million times. Jesus is in the upper room. He knows Judas is going to betray him. And you read that verse, it says he took the piece of bread, right? He dips it, and he gives it to Judas. Now, there are people who go on to the next verses where he says to Judas, go on and do what you're going to do quickly. And they say that that's what the bread symbolizes. Show me that in anywhere else in the Bible. What does bread mean in the Bible when you break bread with somebody? It's an openness of love. Jesus is at the end with Judas. He knows what Judas is about to do. And instead of having some type of weak, worthless, disposable grace, Jesus shows enduring grace. And up to the last second, Jesus is extending him the bread and say, eat with me the bread of life. Share life with me. Turn from what you're doing. This is the message, I think, of Jesus, the bread of love and friendship and shared life, enduring grace. Jesus didn't just tell us to have that in our lives. He showed us how it's done. And then he takes and he washes their feet, and you all know the whole bit there where, you know, Peter says, oh, if you're going to wash my feet, wash all of me. All this confusion swirls around. Jesus still shares supper with them. He still loves them. They don't get it. He has enduring love and grace for his people. So when Judas ultimately does betray Jesus, and he brings the authorities who strip him, they shame him before the world, they whip him, they beat him, they hang him on a cross. And you could look at that and say, see, Jesus extended enduring grace to Judas, and look what it got him. It was failure. Failure is the last word of their relationship. Betrayal, failure, human sin, it's just taken over. But I think if you look at it from the perspective of God, the enduring grace of God, and you see Jesus with those outstretched arms, just as outstretched as they were when he extended the bread to Judas, he said, it's never too late for you to come and receive the enduring grace and love of God. He offers that to the whole world, enduring grace, not disposable grace. And that's the grace that keeps us together as God's family. Folks, we're all going to fail. We have this thing, though, right? When we fail, usually we want to cover it up and figure out a way to pin the blame on somebody else. I had 7 brothers. Believe me, I had a lot of practice at this. Cover up your mistake, pin it on somebody else. But this supper, this life as the family of God, is about the opposite. It's about telling the truth about who we are. It's about agreeing with God. It's about confessing our sins and saying, Lord, when I partake of this, I again remind myself that I come as one who stands in need of grace. And I'm not here to criticize anyone else. I'm here to say, I need your broken body. I need your shed blood. I need your enduring grace. So let's remember that as we share the supper together.